Welcome to the Western Spirit. Today we have a very special guest. Congressman Richie Torres has served in the United States House of Representatives since 2021, and he represents the Bronx. And since October 7, I got to know him through Twitter, X, etc. But way before that, he's been a supporter of Israel, and it's an honor, first of all, to talk to you. And I guess my first question is, as someone who grew up in Brooklyn, I came to Israel like about a decade ago. I look back at what's happened in Columbia, NYU the last few days. How should we feel about what's happening right now in the U.S., especially New York?
Look, higher education is ground zero for a crisis of anti-Semitism in America. You know, I've been sounding the alarm long before the latest outbreak of anti-Semitism. You know, I have long felt that our college campuses, as well as our social media platforms, are indoctrinating the next generation of Americans with a hatred for Israel that is so visceral and fanatical that it renders them indifferent to the value of Jewish life. And the organizations driving the anti-Israel and Cameron movement in places like Columbia are fundamentally anti-Semitic. Organizations like Students for Justice in Palestine, or Within Our Lifetime, these organizations openly advocate for the violent destruction of Israel's Jewish state. These organizations openly celebrate October 7th and rationalize and romanticize the terrorism of Hamas as quote-unquote resistance. You know, the media should stop calling the encampment movement an anti-war protest. If you're celebrating Hamas and October 7th, the deadliest day for Jews since the Holocaust, then you are not anti-war and pro-peace. You are pro-war and anti-peace. And so the encampment movement should be seen for what it is, as a war on Israel as a Jewish state.
And yeah.
The fact that the supreme leader of Iran, which is the leading sponsor of terrorism in the world, would enthusiastically endorse the encampment movement tells you everything you need to know. And you might have seen one of the lead organizers of the Columbia encampment movement, a scoundrel by the name of Kamani Jennings, was caught on video saying that Zionists, i.e. most Jews, do not deserve to live.
Yeah.
That Zionists should be grateful to him for not going out there and murdering them. The depth of anti-Semitism is hard to overstate.
And Congressman Torres, so as a Jew who has family in New York, in your state, very close to NYU, I have an aunt that lives in the Village, which is right next to there, where also they had a lot of these types of protests. How scared should we be that the next generation is being totally indoctrinated into all this, like, on colleges, that, you know, these are the next leaders? You're a young leader. You're meeting with these people who are coming up through the system of higher education and then jobs, the corporate world, I assume, and then at some point will be the next politicians. Should we be worried that we might be seeing a new America that's very scary for us?
You know, for me, the post-October 7th world did not change the state of anti-Semitism in America. It revealed the state of anti-Semitism in America. It revealed what has long been unfolded on social media platforms and college campuses. It's been brewing, but it has finally reached a boiling point, and the crisis has become too glaring to ignore. But I'm alarmed. You know, it's hard not to see what is happening on social media and college campuses and not worry deeply about the future of America and the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship. And we have to mobilize to confront that its root cause.
I wanted to ask you also about yourself. You've been vocal about your support for Israel, but I think also, if I remember correctly, I read you also said that you're vocal about your support for America, and the fact that being for Israel is being for America in this what's happening. It's not a political per se. And so do you think that, and that these, I've seen that there's been reports of people protesting outside your office and stuff like that. Are you paying a political price for your stance right now because it's so, I guess, polarizing, the issue?
I'm paying both the political and the personal price. You know, hemorrhaging support politically. I've lost. I've been excommunicated from the progressive movement. I've seen strain on both personal and political relationships.
Wow.
Members of my immediate family have been the target of harassment. There's no issue in which I face more ease harassment and death threats than other subject of Israel. And I was the target of vile racism from Muhammad Hadid, who was the father of both Gigi and Bella Hadid. He said, shockingly, that I'm worse than the rats of the New York City sewage system. And that I should wear a KKK mask to cover that ugly, gray-colored face of mine.
Wow.
Which, you know, should have provoked widespread outrage in the mainstream media. But in American society, if you're a person of color and pro-Israel, then you become fair game for racist now.
It's unbelievable. I didn't even know that, but it's like, I can't believe, it's like, I don't even know how to process what you just said. And maybe one other thing, that you're a person of color and also you're gay. And when I'm reading about what's happening, I remember I met with Palestinians who ran away from the Gaza Strip, who escaped because of their sexual orientation. We had a meeting with them as journalists a few years back. And the stories they tell is just, it's unbelievable. Just the persecution, the murder, and then we see in these protests, you know, that Queers for Palestine and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, you could take two places. One is Tel Aviv, where you have gay bars, you have the pride parades and all that. And then you go to Gaza. And like I said, you wouldn't, it's not even comparable. And I don't even, like, how do you explain just the, is it just people that don't know what they're talking about? Or is there something more nefarious at play?
Our country, the one said, the simplest explanation is almost always the best, and stupidity is a simpler explanation than malice. You know, I actually owe Queers for Palestine a debt. I'm for Israel because of Queers for Palestine. about 10 years ago, when I announced I was going to Israel for the first time, I became the target of overwhelming hatred and vitriol, both in person and online, and there was a rally on the steps of City Hall against city council members like me who agreed to travel to Israel. And I remember running into a protester who had a shirt that read Grace for Battlestar. And so I asked her, what is your opinion of Hamas? And it was not a trick question. I sincerely thought she was going to tell me why I support Palestinians, but of course I condemn a terrorist organizations like Hamas. And instead she said the opposite. She said she supports Hamas because for her, Hamas represents the liberation of the Palestinian people and resistance to occupation. And at that moment, I had an epiphany. And I said to myself, the fact that an LGBTQ activist would defend a terrorist organization that systematically and savagely murders LGBTQ people, literally throws them off of roofs, like, that to me was as definitive a sign as any of the other stupidity and moral bankruptcy and absurdity that anti-Zionism has inflicted on progressive politics. And so that insight, that epiphany, was the beginning of my pro-Israel journey. So I owe a great debt to the utter stupidity of Queers for Palestine.
So we both thank them a lot for bringing you over. I wanted to ask you also about U.S.-Israel relationship. It seems to me that that there is sort of like a rift where people, like my relatives who are Democrats in America, will say, we don't like Netanyahu because he's more, I don't know, right wing or per se, whatever. But we like Israel, and we support President Biden's support for Israel. Do you think a lot of times, because of this, like, sort of balancing act, a lot of people find it difficult to be so strongly supportive of Israel, because then they're seen to be maybe supporting Netanyahu in some sense?
No, I mean, not for me. I'm a proud American. I love my country. I do not always love my government.
Right, exactly.
There is more to America there's more to Israel than Netanyahu, just like there's more for Donald Trump.
Exactly.
Never conflate the country with the government.
Government, I agree.
No, but the country endures.
So a few weeks ago, we had the UN resolution where the United States basically voted, abstained about the ceasefire resolution, which said that, which the Israel claimed that didn't put a linkage between releasing the hostages and the ceasefire. America said that it did. Where do you see this rift happening and going forward, where there's all these, like, now Secretary Blinken is saying, we don't have yet an operative plan to go into Rafah. The prime minister or the defense minister said today just now that we do. How do you see Israel and the U.S. going forward in this campaign, wherever it goes?
Well, it's not clear to me what's the nature of these discussions. So if we're debating how to go into Rafah, then that's legitimate. Like, there's a debate between the Israeli experts and the American experts about the best strategy for removing Hamas in power and invading Rafah in a manner that minimizes casualties. That all of that strikes me as reasonable. You would want a healthy debate before undertaking a major operation. But if we're debating whether to go to Rafah, that's a separate question. The question I would simply ask is, how do you remove Hamas from power without going to Rafah? Like, for me, the worst outcome is to fall short of removing Hamas, is to have waged a war that has a high death toll. Fall short of the ultimate goal of removing Hamas. Like, only the removal of Hamas can justify the humanitarian cost of the war in Gaza. And anything short of that, I will be taught, is a strategic failure.
So what you're saying is that we can have discussions about the way to do it, but you have to do it, especially that we did everything we did until now. That would be ridiculous, you're saying. It would be like for nothing.
Would it be better to do that? I think.
Exactly.
If you asked me, if we had three options, do nothing, do everything, or somewhere in between, I think the somewhere in between is the worst option. Because you have the reputational cost of waging what has been challenging war in Gaza without the benefit of removing Hamas from power. That's would be the worst case scenario. So the end goal should be not non-negotiable. The end goal of removing Hamas from power, but the means by which we do it, that can be not negotiable, and that can be the subject of debate among reasonable people.
I wanted two more questions to ask you because I know your time is short. One is the International Court in The Hague. I know that there is members of Congress that are talking about it lately, about trying to relate to The Hague, that they should not take out these arrest warrants, I guess, for the prime minister here and the defense minister. What? And I know that, yes, 2 days ago during the readout of some phone calls that they did with, I guess, messages between the White House and the prime minister's office, was that the White House is very much against it. How are we even supposed to look at it that world organizations are thinking even of taking out arrest warrants on our leaders here?
Look, if the ICC issues baseless arrest warrants against members of the Israeli government, it should be met with a response from the United States. Like, the weaponization of international criminal law cannot be allowed to stand. It sets a dangerous precedent. The ICC is politicizing itself to an extent that we've never seen before. And typically, these investigations unfold over a long period of time. The fact that the ICC is contemplating arrest warrants within a matter of months is inexplicable. I can only conclude that it is politically motivated.
Yeah. Last question. One of the things that in Israel we talk about a lot is about what they call here hasbara. How do we explain ourselves to people like you, people who are not Israeli, people who live in Washington, New York, California, Europe, wherever? And there is a consensus, at least it seems, that we're not doing a good job of it. And one of the things that I was thinking about before talking to you was, is it possible that we are doing a good job of it, and the people who are not being convinced are people who would anyway hate us? So for people in Columbia University who are protesting, like you said, these organizations will never, and the students that support them, I assume will never support us. So is there anything that we can do, in your opinion, better in terms of explaining ourselves and explaining the situation here that is so difficult? And it seems that we're not convincing the young people, at least in America.
I love Israel. I do not necessarily love the public relations of Israel, to be blunt. So you feel your fair criticisms there. But it is not. It's first of all, Israel's up against the strongest PR machine in the world. Like, say what you will about Hamas, which is a genocidal terrorist organization, but it has a genius for PR. And we have a manipulable media in the West that plays right into the hands of Hamas, that treats the Gaza Health Ministry as though it were biblical in its accuracy. I mean, it would be laughable were the stakes not so serious.
Right.
But it's not, having said that, it's not clear what Israel could do to combat the disinformation. It's hard to compete with images of human suffering. And a number of those images are deep fakes, but some of them are real. And we're bombarded with these images, both in traditional media and in social media. And, images are going to radicalize people. Images are going to have an emotional impact on people that distort their thinking. And it's hard to compete with that.
Yeah.
Israel has the unique challenge of waging the first war under the microscope of 24/7 cable news and social media. And that's a losing game. How do you overcome it?
I don't know. It's a lot of times we hear about the ratio between terror combatants and civilians, which is so low in this war. Even if you take Hamas's numbers, we hear about the West Point researcher, the top guy at West Point, who said this is the most meticulous in terms of. And then, as you said, the images, you see a baby who's dead on CNN, and it's how you compete with the stats and the images. It's very, very, it's like I said, it's probably impossible to compete. I don't know.
Yeah, look, and Gaza is a hellscape of water tunnels and booby trap buildings and combatants camouflaged as civilians. Like, Hamas is known to use to hide behind civilians as human shields. It is known to hide military assets in civilian infrastructure, like houses of worship and schools and hospitals. And so the ultimate cause of the high death toll is not Israel. It is Hamas's militarization of its own population. Israel has an interest in minimizing casualties,
right,
whereas Hamas has an interest in maximizing casualties in order to intensify the international pressure against Israel. And when it comes to the accusation of genocide, which is a blood libel against Israel as a Jewish state, here's the fact. Hamas has the will but not the wherewithal to commit genocide against Israel. Whereas Israel has the wherewithal but not the will to commit genocide against the Palestinians. And that's the fundamental difference between the two sides.
Yeah. I was just to conclude, I heard someone say, and it's so true, that Israel has, if it wanted to, and 600 soldiers already died over in the campaign in Gaza since October 7. If Israel wanted to save those soldiers' lives and just destroy Hamas, they would just carpet bomb the whole, and they didn't care about Gaza and civilians. They would probably carpet bomb the whole place. And if they didn't care, but they do care, and they put the soldiers on the line. And I have 3 friends who died tragically in the war, and they didn't die because Israel was committing genocide. On the contrary, they died because the soldiers were going into dangerous areas in order so that Israel didn't carpet bomb, for lack of a better word or phrase, in doing it. So it's just very, very, like you said, it's almost to try to combat that language is almost comical because it's so patently false.
But Hamas has the evil genius of Hamas lies in constructing a battlefield that puts Israel in the tragic position of choosing between at times killing civilians or forfeiting its right to defend itself against the Hamas. And that's a choice that should be thrust upon no country.
Right.
And so I do not envy the quandary in which Israel finds itself.
Yeah. I just want to say for in conclusion that I spoke with a few people before I spoke to you, and I mentioned that I'm going to speak to you, and everybody that I spoke to, left, right, center, said that I should just tell you from the people here that we really appreciate you. And I know that you're first and foremost an American, but I think Israel's values in general are very aligned with America and Western values. And like we said about freedom and sexual freedom, freedom for all minorities, is to me, at least, it's very important. And it's important that Israel stay that way, even though there are different people in Israel that are trying to stop that. And for us, it's important to fight so that we stay a free country. And it's important for us to have friends like you. So thank you very much for being with us. And thank you very much for being on our side.
Yeah, I'll end on this note. You know, the world's Jewish population essentially lives in two countries, the United States and Israel. That's most of the world's Jewish population.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like there's a special relationship between our two countries, and the United States has a special obligation to the Jewish state in order to prevent a repeat of our worst history.
Congressman Richie Torres, it's been a pleasure, and I thank you so much for being with us.
Take care.